been a tough week for the turkey industry, with a massive recall by meatpacking giant Cargill affecting customers and grocers around the country. NPR's Steve Inskeep recently summed it up.
One death has been tied to the contaminated meat, and at least 77 people have been sickened. It is certainly not the largest outbreak of foodborne illness, but in this instance, the strain of salmonella that is making people sick is resistant to several antibiotics.
Good morning, and thanks for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann Fisher, and this hour we're talking food safety. We want you to join the discussion. Have you been sickened by contaminated food? Do you have thoughts or concerns about a lack of oversight by the FDA or other regulators? Do you think there's too much regulation on food suppliers? Give us a call at 614-292-8513. You can also email allsides@wosu.org or post a note on the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. Later in the program, we'll be joined by Beth Johnson, the government affairs consultant for the National Turkey Federation. She's also a former employee at the USDA. We'll also be joined by a representative from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Right now, joining us is Sarah Klein. She's a staff attorney for the Center for Science in Public Interest. That's a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit watchdog and consumer advocacy group focusing on nutritional education and awareness. Sarah Klein, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with exactly what happened with this turkey. I think most of us have heard about it by now, but why has it sickened so many people?
You know, it's fairly common to see salmonella and other pathogens in poultry products, and we're used to hearing about them in ground meats like hamburger. Unfortunately, what we're seeing now are some strains of salmonella that are antibiotic resistant. And what that means is that the bugs have developed a resistance to some of the antibiotics that are commonly used to treat human disease. That's largely because of the way that these animals are being raised. In industrial agriculture, antibiotics are routinely given to animals for various reasons, to promote growth, to treat disease in an entire herd of animals if there's, you know, a small outbreak of disease, and to prevent disease amongst the herd. And the result is that these animals are being exposed to very low levels of antibiotics. That's enough for the pathogens to start developing some resistance. Unfortunately, what that means is that when a consumer contracts a pathogen like that, the drugs that we commonly use to treat them won't be available. And that can result in more severe illnesses, longer illnesses, more hospitalizations. And, you know, we say that the only thing worse than telling a consumer that they're sick with a serious foodborne illness is telling them that their treatment options are limited.
So why are these bacterial, antibacterial salmonella strands allowed to exist, or how do they exist? It seems like they should be rooted out.
Well, the Food and Drug Administration is responsible for regulating what types of antibiotics and how much are allowed to be used on the farm in food production, so for animals that will become food or for animals that are producing food like dairy cows. And FDA has taken a fairly a liberal approach to allowing the use of antibiotics in food. And it's something that I think the agency needs to take a hard look at. You know, there are several ways that we can try to protect consumers from antibiotic-resistant pathogens. One of them is by minimizing the amount of antibiotics that's used in the first place. The other way is by testing for those pathogens during food production and not letting those products get out onto the market. That's something that we've called on USDA, the Department of Agriculture, who's responsible for regulating meat and poultry. We've called on them to increase testing for these types of pathogens so that we won't have to face recalls and outbreaks because the product would never make it out of the factory.
You say that salmonella is something we hear about a lot with poultry. This is obviously a large-scale case, but just how common are salmonella outbreaks?
You know, we've seen salmonella outbreaks several times a year, every year, as far back as we've been tracking outbreaks. Some of them are large. Some of them may only affect a handful of people. And we've seen them in a variety of food items. It's important to note that we're not just talking about meat and poultry when we talk about foodborne illness. Unfortunately, we've seen salmonella in peanut butter. We've seen salmonella in raspberries and in some of our other, you know, really healthy, nutritious foods. And so Salmonella is an environmental pathogen. It's the kind of contaminant that can crop up in, bird waste or in dirty water. And so it's not unheard of, but we need companies to be doing everything they can to ensure that it's not getting into the food. And particularly when we're talking about these antibiotic-resistant strains, it's critically important that we maintain the efficacy of our antibiotics. We're not inventing new antibiotics at the pace that we used to, and so we don't have drugs readily available to replace these once they become impotent against these pathogens.
We're talking with Sarah Klein. She's a staff attorney at the Center for Science in the Public Interest. That's a watchdog group that tries to educate people on nutrition and awareness. If you have a question for her or a question about food oversight, food regulation in this country, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. We do have a couple callers on the line trying to get to you in just a moment. Sarah Klein, in the next segment, we'll be joined by someone from the National Turkey Federation who's also a former employee at the USDA. But help us lay out the chain of command that exists in the food industry. What does the USDA regulate? What does the FDA regulate? What's not regulated at all? Just help us lay that out.
Well, I think consumers will be surprised to hear how many cooks there really are in the kitchen when we talk about regulating food safety. We have FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, which is responsible for basically everything in the grocery store that's in the produce department, everything that's in the center aisles, unless it includes meat, and all of your dairy and eggs, with a few tiny exceptions. FDA is also responsible for all seafood except for catfish. USDA, the Department of Agriculture, is responsible for meat, poultry, catfish, as I said, and some types of eggs. For example, eggs, once they're in their shells, eggs in their normal condition are regulated by the FDA, but once they're cracked open and put into a carton, like an egg beaters type product, a pasteurized egg product, those become the property of the USDA. Similarly, frozen cheese pizza is regulated by FDA, but if you put pepperoni on it from the same facility, that pizza is going to be regulated by USDA. We also have a bunch more federal agencies that are involved in food safety, from the Department of Homeland Security that has its hand in some food import issues, the Environmental Protection Agency, which has something to do with some of the farming and fisheries issues, and the list goes on, but suffice to say, there are a lot of cooks in this kitchen, and that's one of the things that we've been looking at for years and need to be looking at in the years to come. Is there a way to streamline our food safety oversight into perhaps a single food agency that's responsible just for protecting the public health where food is concerned, rather than having all of these different agencies that each have a piece of the pie?
Kim, calling from Youngstown. Good morning, Kim. You're on the air.
Okay. I experienced some vending food, some food from a vendor, and it was lemonade, and there was an eyelash in it, and the ice looked like it was scraped off the side of a freezer. But what I'm asking is this. How could you mess up lemonade, and how could you really pursue some kind of regulation on a vendor? I mean, it's like one of those little sausage vendors, like in front of Giant Eagles.
Yeah, it's very difficult, unfortunately. There are so many things that are allowed to be in our food supply that we would be surprised to know about. For example, many consumers are surprised to know that there is actually a list, you can even access it on the internet, of allowable insects in our food. There are amounts that are okay by the Food and Drug Administration that you can have a certain number of insect wings in a ground spice product, for example, or pulverized beetles can be in a wheat product, as long as they're under a certain amount. So it's very difficult when consumers are confronted with the kind of thing that you mentioned, where you have an eyelash or some sort of foreign object in food. It's very distasteful. But unfortunately, there's little you can do about it. The good news is that apparently you didn't get sick from it, and unfortunately many consumers do get sick from foodborne illness every year.
Kim, thanks so much for your call. When something like this does happen, something like this massive food recall by Cargill, what's the protocol for getting this food out of stores?
You know, it's actually a very complicated procedure. It's a little bit like investigating a crime. You have, and I'm sure your guest from CDC will help people to understand this even more, but you have a whole bunch of people involved in investigating what caused the problem. You have your state and local health department. These are kind of our frontline, boots-on-the-ground investigators who are getting information from physicians, who are getting calls from consumers who are reporting illness. And then they're starting to actually interview sick consumers to ask them what they might have eaten in the last several days or week to try and piece together what's the common element here among all of these different illnesses. They then take that information and they forward it on to the Centers for Disease Control, who try and put together an even larger investigation when they're getting outbreak reports just like that from several states or several different places in the country. Once they put that together, then they start to zero in on production facilities and they say, okay, now we've narrowed it down to what we think is the product. Where could these people have gotten the product? Eventually, it leads to retailers. In a best-case scenario, when we figure out exactly what has caused the problem, it leads back to retailers, and product is removed from shelves by either the retailers or representatives from the production facility. So I'm sure that there are people from Cargill who are calling all of their vendors, all of the retailers that carry their product, to make sure that that product is being pulled off the shelves and disposed of properly.
And Cargill is, of course, a domestic company, but we have a question about imported foods. David calling from San Francisco. Good morning.
Yeah. Out here in San Francisco, we're a big pork town, and we've got a lot of these dollar stores. So it's interesting that you were talking about the, once it's pulled off the shelves, does it end up going to some sort of an auction and it ends up in the dollar store? But, in the inspections, I keep hearing about these budget cuts for inspectors, and is there a way of determining what percentage of the food that's coming in from overseas is being inspected? For example, if I understand right, there's a larger and larger percentage of milk that's actually coming from Argentina. And so they must get a massive subsidy for shipping that milk up here, halfway around the world. And milk producers are just starving and dying in America while the while milk is produced probably at a penny a gallon in Argentina and shipped all the way up here to compete and whether or not it's even inspected. And I happen to also think of a third thing. I remember during the Bush administration, they had a lot of radioactive wastes, and so they were starting to irradiate food, and they were allowing more feces into hamburger meat, and they considered that they didn't have to, because they were running it through essentially an X-ray machine, it would kill the germs on the feces, so they could allow a higher percentage of feces in hamburger. So it gives a whole... whole new concept of the S-burger.
Well, I don't think we need to comment on that one, Sarah Klein, but can you major differences between how food is inspected, food that's been imported versus food produced domestically?
Imports are a really interesting and troubling area, frankly, for food safety. It's been estimated that less than 2% of the food that's coming into the country is actually inspected at the border. When we think about that, we are getting so much of our food from outside the U.S. 80% of our seafood, for example, is imported.
80%?
For produce, it can be, depending on the types of food, it can be as much as 40%. And so little of that is actually inspected, partly because we just don't have enough federal inspectors to do the inspection. And we're talking about mass quantities of food coming over the border. They come over on enormous tankers, and then they're in huge crates. And often what's called an inspection may be as simple as an inspector walking around a crate to make sure that it seems to be intact and that there aren't any obvious signs that the crate has either been tampered with or has been breached by rodents or anything of that nature. The amount of food that actually goes through any sort of technical inspection where food is sampled and sent to labs for testing for pathogens is very, very small. Unfortunately, we do have to note that, just like in this particular case, we have seen foodborne outbreaks from domestic product as well as imported. And so it's difficult to really say that food that is produced domestically is per se safer because we've seen outbreaks from both. It's also important to note that a lot of food that we consider to be domestically produced, because it's coming from a company that's here in the U.S. and may have a packing facility here in the U.S., may also be bringing in food from abroad as part of their production line. So they may be receiving food from Mexico or Argentina that then gets repackaged into a U.S. label. So it's a very complicated system, and there's really no black or white when it comes to food imports.
We're talking food safety this hour. Joining us now on the phone is Sarah Klein. She's a staff attorney with the Center for Science in the Public Interest. That's a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit watchdog and consumer advocacy group focusing on nutritional education and awareness. We're going to take a quick break, and then on the other side of that, we'll be joined by Beth Johnson. She's the Government Affairs Consultant for the National Turkey Federation. You're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.
Where do you go for rich conversation on the topics that matter most? The radio is more responsive than the water cooler, and we take your calls. I'm Neil Conan. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. Join us for provocative talk on the issues you really care about. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation
this
here.
This afternoon at 2 on 89.7 NPR News.
Just what I was about to say. In the weather forecast for Central Ohio, a chance of showers this afternoon, about a 30% chance, otherwise a high of around 83 degrees. Tonight, again, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly before 2 a.m., a low around 65. On Wednesday, we'll have a high of 79 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from the state auto insurance companies, providing home, automobile, and business insurance products and services to Central Ohioans since 1921. State Auto is on the web at stateauto.com.
Welcome back to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann Fisher. In this hour, we're talking food safety. Still with us is Sarah Klein. She's an attorney with the watchdog group Center for Science in the Public Interest. That's a Washington-based watchdog group. And joining us now also is Beth Johnson. She's the Government Affairs Consultant for the National Turkey Federation. That's a group that calls itself the National Advocate for all segments of the turkey industry. Beth Johnson, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much. Why should people still have faith in the turkey industry? Why should we eat turkey without worrying about the safety?
That's I greatly appreciate, like I said, the opportunity to talk to you today about turkey and the tremendous benefits. It's a nutrient-rich, low-fat protein source that is an excellent way to help meet your nutrient needs. Also, from the standpoint, my previous history, I think you said earlier, as a government official acting undersecretary for food safety over at USDA, certainly we know that this is a product that, although it's very, very unfortunate that we're experiencing the recent recall, we do know that with proper handling and proper cooking, this is a very safe product. And so it's a great way to make sure you get your important nutrients that you need every day.
How much have sales of turkey slipped since the Cargill recall? Can you speak to that at all?
I think that I haven't seen any specific figures or anything. Certainly anecdotally, in the discussions that I've had with folks and both professionally and personally, I actually just left your great state of Ohio on vacation. Individuals that I know continue to be very positive about ground turkey. They understand that bacteria is naturally there, and that they do have to cook it and properly handle it. And so certainly the confidence remains high, and we're very happy with that.
But I have to assume, I hate to assume, but sales surely have slipped, right? After the E. coli outbreak with spinach, we saw that the spinach industry was devastated for quite some time. You're saying it's not quite that bad, or it has slipped somewhat, or how would you characterize it?
Well, I think it's real different, too. Again, I have not seen any figures, but you have to consider when you look at produce versus meat. One thing with meat is that you, as a consumer, you have the ability to properly cook the product and have a completely safe product. It's a little bit tougher with fresh produce that you eat raw. Mm-hmm. So it is a very different product, and to make that one-on-one comparison would not be appropriate.
Someone posted it on our Facebook page this morning when we were talking about food safety and issues related to recalls like this. They wrote, "Go vegan." Obviously, with the spinach scare that we had a few years ago, that's not entirely the case. But is that a sentiment that you're seeing at all? If people would go vegan, they wouldn't face issues like this salmonella outbreak.
No. Again, I think, like you said, is that salmonella is one of those bacteria, as other types of bacteria are in products, whether it be produce or protein products. And we in the United States are fortunate to have among the safest food supply in the world, but nothing is completely free of that. And again, it's unfortunate when it happens. It's not something any of us like to see, and something that we all want very much to work for public health and find those answers from the public health side. But looking at a diet where there are not meat or animal protein sources, is I'm actually a dietitian as well as a former USDA. USDA person as well as a mom, and I can tell you that personally trying to get a diet that kids will eat in particular, but any of us will eat, that doesn't contain meat but also provides all the appropriate nutrients that we all need and is low fat is tough, and turkey's a great way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Tough but doable. People would I think most people would say it is doable, but it's tough.
It is doable.
Listeners, give us a call. We're talking food safety this hour. What are your thoughts on food safety in the country? Is food oversight strong enough? Is it too weak? Give us a call. We're joined by Sarah Klein. She's a staff attorney with the Center for Science in the Public Interest. And also with us is Beth Johnson. She's the government affairs consultant for the National Turkey Federation. That's a trade group. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. And Beth Johnson, we spent the first part of this show walking over exactly what happened with the Cargill recall. In your group's mind, what happened? How did this happen?
Well, and I did hear Sarah talk about some of this. When any kind of outbreak happens, clearly, like I said, it's very, very unfortunate. It's also very difficult, and I spent a number of years at USDA, and it's very difficult to determine what the source of that outbreak is. USDA, working with CDC and the state, work hard and as quickly as they can, but it still takes a lot of time to figure out where that source is coming from, and oftentimes, we're never sure, and although we have indications and likelihoods that it could have come from a particular source, we're actually never quite sure. And so I think in this is one of those cases where it's been very, very difficult to come up to exact conclusions. And what we need to do now is work together to make sure that as we look forward and respond, we do it in a thoughtful way that is public health based. And I think those are some of the things that we're looking at now.
But they are pretty sure in this case, right? The infection started at a processing plant in Springdale, Arkansas.
They're actually, and this is something that you're going to, would be better coming from USDA and CDC can talk about that. But, again, there are lots of things that go into this investigation, and we're not privy to all of those answers, nor, I doubt, is CSPI. There's still a lot of questions that remain, as I understand it. And so, everybody takes as many proactive actions as they deem appropriate, and certainly Cargill did, but there are lots of things, but the important thing is that we're proactive, and we look for preventive steps as we move forward.
What all meats were recalled? Was it just ground turkey?
It was ground turkey, and I think crumbles as well.
36 million pounds. Is this an indictment of the country's meat processing industry? And, you know, in recent decades, we've seen an increase in these so-called mega farms and fewer family farms. Some people say that that opens up the country for outbreaks like this.
Absolutely not. I think that, you know, it is really interesting, too, when you look at this. Certainly pathogens can be anywhere. And fortunately, when we look at different types of farms or processing methods or things like that, some of the best ones are able to implement a lot of different practices that can reduce the incidence of foodborne pathogens. And so I think that it by no means has any kind of there are a lot of things that are still out there that a lot of different ways that we have to look at this. And, you know, some of the safest mm-hmm. products are coming from these large, manufacturers, but plants. But at the same time, you know, we have to look all across the spectrum, small versus large. Food safety isn't a particular responsibility of one versus the other. And we need to make sure that whatever we do, whatever actions that we are supporting and taking, are providing the safest product that we can for individuals.
And I'm not a chicken farmer. I'm far from it. But it would seem to me that a small family farm could never recall 36 million pounds of ground meat.
Well, where that product goes is probably where it's grown and then where it goes into the processing facility would impact how much is there. But there are a lot of different things that can happen in small versus large, and it is something that we do have to be very mindful that from my experience working at USDA. Although you may not have seen the amount, you certainly, it was not unheard of to see small facilities having issues as well. And again, the important part is looking at prevention in a public health process that can be used across the spectrum so that we're preventing these problems. Mm-hmm. And size is not the implicator of whether there's going to be a problem or not.
We've been talking this morning about how this strain of salmonella has been antibiotic resistant. We have a comment in that regard from David. David in German Village calling. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome.
Concerning this, and I think the young lady just speaking, you know, small farms, large farms, I think the one thing that a lot of people don't understand is that 36 million pounds of ground turkey probably comes from thousands of small farms as well as large farms. Companies like Cargill, and I know this for a fact, they have so many contracts with so many small farmers, they have the same problem with the small as they do the large. But what I was going to talk about and ask about and get some confirmation, hopefully, is the injecting of the same antibiotics and added hormones to our cattle that we eat every day. I know it's been suggested by the USDA, as a matter of fact, that these cattle will also become resistant to the antibiotics, and in turn, we ingest that same antibiotic and will become resistant to a lot more antibiotics, I think, than just because the ones that this turkey problem has caused. Animals are fed products from the cattle. We give dogs, dog bones, they have the antibiotics from the cattle. This is a problem that's going to be so invasive, I think, and I need confirmation, that it'll be mind-boggling what the repercussions will be. Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, you don't think something can happen to your pet dog or your cat or whatever animal you have that have fed animal and animal byproducts that have been treated with antibiotics and added hormones. We as humans should be smart enough, I think, to buy products that have not been an antibiotic. That's called ABF in the trade. I mm-hmm. own an advertising agency here in German Village, so okay. You know, I don't know a lot about what I'm talking about, but I think some of it is probably, you know, pretty viable comments.
Yeah, well, David, let's put that question to our guests here. Sarah Klein might be better suited to speak to that. Ms. Klein, is that a concern at all, these antibiotics and other things that are put into our meat products making their way into our body?
Absolutely. The caller makes an excellent point. What we're seeing in food production is a lot of antibiotic use, again, for three primary reasons. We've got growth promotion, we have disease prevention, and we have disease treatment. And what happens is antibiotics are given to animals in low levels. The animals develop resistance, the pathogens develop resistance, and in turn, the resistance is spread when humans ingest the meat. We also see very interesting things like, for example, antibiotics that are approved for use in poultry that are not approved for use in cattle, but we have a problem that's called poultry litter, where all of the stuff that goes through the poultry, so everything that's coming through the chicken, whether it's feed, feces, antibiotics, ends up on the floor of the chicken coop, and at the end of a growth cycle is gathered together, composted, and then fed to cattle because we don't want it to go to waste. Well, now you've got cattle ingesting antibiotics that are approved for use in poultry. It's clear that antibiotic use on farms is a problem that has emerged in the U.S. We used to say that antibiotic resistance was an emerging hazard. It is here, and we need to deal with it. CSPI believes mm-hmm. that there's several ways to deal with it. First, we need FDA and the industry to take a good, hard look at how they're using antibiotics in animal production. And second, we need USDA and the industry to be testing for these antibiotic-resistant pathogens at the end of the production cycle to ensure that they never reach consumers. We petitioned the agency on mm-hmm. four particular strains of antibiotic-resistant salmonella just several months ago. One of those strains was the one that's implicated in this outbreak. So just as Beth said, we need to be looking at public health, we need to be looking at prevention, and there are several ways to do that that the government and the industry need to partner on.
Beth Johnson, you work with the National Turkey Federation, not with any chicken or beef associations, and I assume that you would make a case for the use of some antibiotics.
Well, I think that, again, I think it's important to remember that I'm also a mom and a dietitian, and always looking for making sure that I'm providing my family with the safest product around. You know, I think a couple of things that need to be considered through this process is, one, that and I'm not aware of any pathogens that are resistant to all drugs. And so when we talk about antibiotic-resistant pathogens, they're resistant to one or sometimes more. Certainly there are multi-drug-resistant pathogens. And that happens relative to what, unfortunately, my doctors give my kids in the if the product is mishandled, as I, as a mom, give my child, or other reasons. And so I think, you know, it's really, really important that we look at all of this in totality. And just like your kids getting sick, animals get sick. And we have to think about the fact that there are many different reasons why we give antibiotics to animals. And to just simply go and say that, you know, we need to look at these and stop, you know, limit the products that are given to animals. You know, certainly this has been looked at many, 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 many years. Mm-hmm. And frankly, there have been certain drugs that are no longer given to animals. But if you look in Denmark and other places where they have stopped giving certain types of antibiotics, you don't see a decrease in antibiotic resistance. So the important thing with a lot of this is that you, with any of these pathogens, you know, we're looking at prevention, whether it's antibiotic resistant or not. We're looking at prevention, and we have to make sure that you know, if we cook a product that has a pathogen in it, whether it's antibiotic resistant or not, the pathogen is dead. The antibiotic resistance is no longer an issue. Yeah. And so, you know, the mere fact of being antibiotic resistant is if someone gets sick, and that's clearly a problem. We don't like to see that, whether it's caused in human drugs or animal drugs. But again, we have to make sure then that we look for the best ways to make sure that we have the safest product possible, and that's both from the industry perspective, government perspective, and the consumer perspective.
But do the previous caller and Sarah Klein have a point that we do need to make some changes to the way antibiotics are used?
You know, the right now, I'll be honest, is from the science basis. I mean, certainly from an emotional standpoint, there is that gets a lot of attention. But from a science basis, you know, FDA is looking at this. They've got a couple of different proposals that are out there, but we have not. The science hasn't proven out. When I said, like, when we look at Denmark and we look at when they have banned the use of certain types of antibiotics and for certain uses, we're just not seeing the results that folks are indicating that we are. So mm-hmm. I would argue that I think that we have a lot of other things that you know, we need to look at this in totality and make sure that, you know, we've got limited resources. We need to make sure that we're spending our resources appropriately and that we're really getting the public health outcome that is gonna make a significant difference, as opposed to something that is gonna sound good.
Well, Beth Johnson,
Steve,
from the go ahead, Sarah Klein, very quickly.
If I may just quickly respond, I just want to note for consumers that we've seen outbreaks that have had resistant pathogens that have been resistant to up to 11 different drugs. This current outbreak, we have 4 human drugs that this pathogen is resistant to. So it's a very serious problem. Beth is right that consumers should be practicing what they can do at home to protect themselves. We call it defensive eating. Buy a meat thermometer, use it particularly when you're preparing these ground meat and poultry products. Internal temperature for poultry should be 165. We mm-hmm. do urge consumers to do that. But again, that's the last line of defense, and we need industry and government to ensure that they're taking the preventive steps on the farm and during testing to make sure that those products are not contaminated when they reach consumers' homes.
Well, Sarah Klein with the Center for Science and the Public Interest, thank you so much for your time this morning. And Beth Johnson
thank
from
you.
The National Turkey Federation, thank you as well.
Thank you, and I agree completely that we all do need to make sure that mm-hmm. we take all the steps that we can. So we just mm-hmm. need to make sure we take the right steps so that we see a public health outcome.
Okay, thank you so much. You've been listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be back in just a minute with a representative from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the books and religious beliefs that have influenced Michelle Bachmann with Ryan Lizza. He profiles Bachmann in the current edition of The New Yorker. And New York Times reporter Andrea Elliott talks about the man behind the movement to create state laws banning Sharia law. Join us.
Fresh Air comes your way starting in about 10 minutes here at 89.7 NPR News. 3 Steps to Incredible Health with Dr. Joel Fuhrman. It directly addresses the crisis of obesity and chronic disease that plagues America. More than 65% of Americans are overweight or obese, and that number is growing, just like our waistlines. Dr. Fuhrman's revolutionary health plan isn't about willpower, it's about knowledge. 3 Steps to Incredible Health offers an effective plan for shedding weight quickly and reclaiming good health. Watch tomorrow night at 8 o'clock on WOSU TV 34, Dr. Joel Fuhrman and 3 Steps to Incredible Health. As far as the weather forecast goes for central Ohio, today a chance of showers mainly in the afternoon and a high of about 83, 30% chance of rain. And then tonight, a chance of thunderstorms, mainly before 2 a.m., a low around 65 and 30% chance. Later on, Wednesday, we'll have sunny skies. Tomorrow's high about 79, and Wednesday night's low 58. And almost the same thing for Thursday. By Friday, still sunshine, but just a little bit warmer.
Welcome back to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann Fisher, and this hour we're talking food safety. We've already talked with the Food Watchdog Group and the National Turkey Federation. We're about to be joined by Tom Skinner. He is a representative from the Centers for Disease Control and prevention, and he may just be on the line right now. Mr. Skinner?
Yes, it's me, Tom Skinner.
How you doing, sir? Thanks so much. Thanks for joining All Sides.
No problem. Glad to be with you.
So from the CDC's point of view, from your perspective, what exactly has happened with this recall? That's a big question, but when did CDC first start getting word of it, and what's happened in your office since then?
Well, we know of reports of illness dating back to March. It wasn't until the end of May, really, that we saw some clustering of cases that sort of sounded some alarm bells, if you will. An investigation began to look into these illnesses. And, you know, these investigations take time. So we got toward the end of July and realized that what we were dealing with here was some ground turkey that was the most likely source of the outbreak. And then the United States Department of Agriculture worked with the company to recall product. Chances are there's still a lot of product out there in people's freezers and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to make sure that people continue to cook their ground turkey thoroughly to an internal temperature of 165 to be safe.
You talk about why it took so long to issue the recall. I've seen a lot of criticism reading from the Christian Science Monitor here. Ground turkey recall, why the lag between illnesses and a public alert? And you saying it's just a matter of compiling the proper amount of data in order to make a call on what appears to have happened.
These investigations are very labor-intensive and just take time to conduct. When we learn of some illness, we then have to track the people down. We have to do thorough interviews with them. We have to determine what the sick people ate to get sick and what, you know, and compare that to what we call case controls. And those are people that are close to the sick individuals who may have eaten something different and not gotten sick. So these investigations just take time to, thoroughly investigate to come up with a source.
Listeners, give us a call. Our phone number is 614-292-8513. Again, 614-292-8513. We're talking food safety this hour, and we're joined by Tom Skinner. He's a representative from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Julie on the line from Powell has a question about cooking turkey. Go ahead, Julie.
Yes, I just want to know if I cook my turkey fully, is it not safe for my family to consume?
The key is making sure you properly cook your ground turkey to an internal temperature of 165 degrees. Normally, if people are cooking ground turkey, you know, it may not be feasible to actually use a meat thermometer. So, making sure that the ground turkey is not pink and that the juices run clear and they're not red can also be beneficial. But really, the safest way is to actually use a meat thermometer and make sure that the internal temperature of your ground turkey is 165 degrees.
Mm-hmm. Julie, thanks so much for your call. I have another call this morning from Peter. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, I heard that shrimp are being raised overseas in shallow ponds of filthy water, and they are adding some kind of antibiotic to this water to keep the shrimp healthy. And then that we buy these frozen shrimp and maybe we get loose bowels from eating these shrimp. Is there any truth in that?
Thomas, is that something you can speak to at all?
No, I'm not familiar with that situation that the gentleman describes, and I really, don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, sorry, Peter. Wish we could answer your question. So what's the protocol for recall as far as CDC? Walk us through the process as far as you walked us through this particular Cargill process, but is that typical for what happens?
Well, CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, is responsible for investigating the outbreaks, trying to determine who is sick, how many people are sick, and what's making them sick. And we work side by side with the United States Department of Agriculture to identify sources. And actually, the USDA conducts the traceback investigation to find out where the product came from and how it became contaminated. And then the USDA is normally the one that works with the companies on the actual recall.
And we do have another call this morning, Jody, calling from Worthington. Jody, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, Jody. You're on the air.
Okay. Hello. I'm wondering how much the budget has been cut for for this gentleman that's doing the investigating. People are outraged that they didn't find it sooner, but they also want the government budgets cut. Is that have anything to do with how quickly they were able to come up with their where the source of the contamination was?
Tom Skinner, have any budget cuts made your office less nimble, less able to quickly respond to something like this?
Well, your caller raises a very important point. You know, when it comes to the United States' ability to detect these foodborne outbreaks, we're only as strong as our weakest link. And sometimes the weakest link are those on the front line, and that's our state and local health departments across the country. They are the ones that are, you know, monitoring and detecting these foodborne outbreaks, and then they'll call in CDC for assistance. You know, we live in tough times, tight budgets. We have, as a country, you know, budget deficits like we've never seen before, and we're just going to have to make some really hard choices when it comes to, you know, what we spend our money on in the United States. You know, our policymakers have really tough choices. I can say, though, that resources, you know, that go to the states and local health departments to detect these outbreaks are vitally important. And, you know, more resources would allow us to, you know, respond more swiftly, faster. So that's just something that we have to keep in mind as we move forward.
So budget cuts could make our food supply in the country less safe. I was reading an interesting story about how customer loyalty cards at grocery stores have helped regulators track down who purchased possibly contaminated turkey. Have you seen anything?
Yeah, that's correct. So we're able to use the information that's found, you know, that's taken from these cards sometimes, and, you know, use that information to help us track down source of outbreak. So those have been very, very helpful and have certainly expedited the traceback process. You know, so that's one way that we do, you know, investigate and use the information for tracebacks.
We're talking with Tom Skinner. He's a representative from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We're talking about food safety. Give us a call at 614-292-8513. Again, that's 614-292-8513. And earlier in the program, Tom, we were talking about so-called mega farms possibly lending themselves to massive outbreaks like this. This type of outbreak seems less likely at small family-operated farms. Is that an indictment of mega farms at all?
Well, you know, one thing that we stress the importance of when it comes to foodborne disease is really making sure that we have a really thorough understanding of the problem from the farm all the way to the table. And so there's a lot of steps in between. You do mention farms and how we raise our poultry and cattle. Then we move to the, you know, the slaughtering and packaging process. And then we move to distribution to grocery stores, and then from grocery stores to the home, and then how, you know, people in their homes prepare their products. While we have the safest food supply, or one of the safest food supplies in the entire world, it's just the way it is. And people are going to have to assume that, you know, the products that they're bringing into their homes, chicken, beef products, may not be totally bacteria-free. And so we will never get away from the message of the importance of people properly handling their food inside their home. They're always going to have to prepare their food properly, internal cooking temperatures, making sure we pay close attention to cross-contamination issues in the kitchen, you know, not cutting your chicken on the same cutting board that you use to cut your fruit, you know, your fruits and vegetables and that sort of thing. We're always going to have to pay close attention to those kinds of things to be safe.
Why did Ohio seem to have so many people get sick? Is it just a matter of distribution, more of this contaminated meat coming to our state than other states?
It could be distribution. It could be that the folks there in Ohio have a really robust system for detecting disease, reporting disease, as opposed to another state. We see a lot of variability across the country in the state's abilities to detect foodborne disease, detect outbreaks, and to investigate. So it may be just a sign of a really good health system there in Ohio.
just to catch all our listeners up, 76 people sickened nationwide. That's the number of people confirmed that have been sickened by this outbreak in ground turkey. 10 of those have come in Ohio. That ties Ohio with Michigan as the most among any state. One person has been killed as a result of this salmonella outbreak as well. Give us a call, 614-292-8513. If you have a question for Tom Skinner, he is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Tom, do you think Cargill has handled this appropriately? Anything else you would have liked to have seen them do?
You know, I'm certainly not, in position to be a Monday morning quarterback when it comes to how they've responded. I do know that they worked very quickly with the USDA to institute the recall once we had information suggesting that it could be ground turkey. So, I think they moved very swiftly.
We're talking with Sarah Klein from the Center for Science and the Public Interest this morning, and she was talking about the kind of patchwork, that oversight that exists. So seafood is subject to FDA regulation, except when it's catfish, and sometimes eggs are subject to the USDA regulation, but when they get cracked, they become subject to another regulatory agency. Does that make your job more difficult, this kind of patchwork of regulatory oversight that exists here in the country?
Now, we really work with USDA, but also we work with them, independently as well. And so we're able to do what we need to do to investigate foodborne outbreaks from the human side, working with state and local health departments. We collaborate with them, but at the same time, we're able to do what we need to do investigating human disease.
In general, how worried should people be about the safety of their food in this country? I know you talk about some bacteria is never really going away, but in general, just to kind of sum up our conversation here, is our food supply safe?
Our food supply is safe, and we have one of the safest food supplies in the entire world. But with that said, people just should never lose sight of the fact that it's really important to properly cook their meat products, to wash their fruits and vegetables before they consume them, and to make sure that they, pay close attention to issues of cross-contamination in the kitchen when it comes to food, preparing food. Mm-hmm. That's a message we're never going to be able to, or we should never get away from.
Let's try and get in one last caller. Naomi calling from Columbus. Good morning, Naomi.
Hi, good morning.
Really quickly, if you can.
Oh, yeah, sure. I read in the paper that Mexico is going to start operating slaughterhouses, and I was just curious. That kind of sent a cold chill up my spine. I was curious how safe that beef will be, and how will we know if our beef is coming from Mexico?
Tom Skinner, I don't know if you can answer that. Would you have any concerns about slaughterhouses in Mexico?
I don't know enough about that to really to be able to comment on that. That, again, that'll be up to the United States Department of Agriculture to work with officials there to make sure food coming or beef products coming from Mexico meet the standards that we have set here in the United States.
Sure. Well, Naomi, sorry we can't answer your question there, and that will have to do it. We could talk about food safety for days, I'm sure, but up against the clock here, Tom Skinner, a representative from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And you're very welcome. And you've been listening to All Sides here on WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media. And thanks so much this morning for my producer, Charlie Pickard, and also Leticia Wiggins, who's helped me out so much, and Linda Taylor as well. Thank you all so much. Again, you're listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.